Welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM, FM HD1, Galveston 89.5 FM, and Huntsville 91.7 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on dozens of radio stations in different US and European cities. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1177, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the latest electronic intifada newscast covering the ongoing Israeli genocide, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing in occupied Palestine. During the second segment, I will air an opinion recorded for Middle East Eye by Soumaya Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, about some states' declarations that they might recognize a Palestinian state, in which she says, quote, "A state that needs its oppressor's permission to exist is not a state, it's a diplomatic mirage sold over mass graves," unquote. During the third segment, I will air a couple of the remarks delivered at the Gaza Tribunal held in Sarajevo. I will air the remarks of Professor Maryam Jamshidi, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Colorado Law School, on the protection of civilians. And I will air a witness testimony by a volunteer physician in Gaza, Dr. Mimi Sayed, an American emergency medicine physician and assistant clinical professor at the University of Washington and Washington State University. Let's begin with the latest electronic intifada newscast covering the ongoing Israeli genocide, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing in occupied Palestine.
This is the electronic intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 671 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombed and attacked areas across Gaza this week, killing at least 730 Palestinians and injuring nearly 4,500 between July 30th and August 6th. according to the official records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. More than 130 Palestinians were killed between Tuesday and Wednesday alone, 87 of whom were killed while trying to acquire food aid. Aerial footage of Israel's 22-month rampage of destruction of nearly every square inch of Gaza was released to Western audiences this week, as a few Western reporters accompanied airdrops of scant parcels of aid. Some images were released before Israeli officials threatened journalists that these aid drops could be canceled if media workers shared the footage any further. Israel's attacks this week targeted residential buildings, tent shelters, and health clinics, while the army issued new forced displacement orders in northern and central Gaza. The United Nations Humanitarian Office stated on Wednesday that the new orders span 1.5 square miles across 5 neighborhoods in Gaza City and Khan Yunis governorates. Shelter materials have not been allowed to enter Gaza since March 2nd. The few shelter materials that are available on the local market are extremely expensive and limited in quantity, putting them out of reach for most families, the UN stated. Israel also attacked tents of displaced people west of Khan Yunis on Wednesday, killing at least 2 women, while other airstrikes struck areas east of Gaza City, killing at least 3 people. Reporter Saad Hezbollah filmed a young boy desperately searching through the rubble for his grandparents, who were killed in an airstrike in Gaza City earlier this week. At night on Tuesday, August 5th, Israel bombed a health clinic belonging to the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. The building had been used as a shelter for displaced families. A mother sheltering there with her children told Al Jazeera reporters that they were sitting, quote, when suddenly everyone started running. People told us we had 10 minutes before the clinic would be bombed. I grabbed the kids and ran without taking anything. We moved about 200 meters away and waited. The strike hit the building. Around 1 or 2 a.m., when things calmed down, we went back, but everything was gone. The tents were torn apart, everything destroyed, she added. Journalist Ahmed Adanaf captured the bombing of the Sheikh Radwan Health Clinic building on video. Israel also bombed buildings belonging to the Palestine Red Crescent Society several times this week. A Red Crescent worker captured video of the bombing of the Khan Yunis headquarters on August 3rd, which killed one staff member, injured 3 others, and sparked a fire. Quote, our headquarters location is well known to the occupying forces and is clearly marked with the protective red emblem. This was not a mistake, the medical organization stated. While medical staff attempted to extinguish the fire and inspect the damage after the first strike, the Red Crescent reported that the building was hit again on the second floor and then again on the ground floor. Quote, the repeated strikes during evacuation and rescue operations clearly demonstrate that the shellings were deliberate and systematic, the Red Crescent stated. On August 6th, just 3 days later, the Israeli army targeted the building again, firing an artillery shell into the 8th floor. Western and regional states who remain in lockstep with Israel and its genocidal policy are continuing their attempts at public relations management by boasting of airdropping meager amounts of food aid. While the crossings remain largely sealed, while Palestinians are killed in vast numbers at U.S. and Israeli so-called aid distribution sites, and while the Gaza population is facing catastrophic levels of starvation. This week, Canada, Germany, and Belgium, along with the UAE, Egypt, and Jordan, airdropped aid as Gaza government officials once again warned that the amount of assistance is only a small fraction of what is needed. On August 1st, Palestinians in Gaza filmed themselves opening up some of the airdropped parcels from Spain, showing that some of the food packets were covered in black mold. The Gaza Ministry of Interior affirmed, quote, that the negative effects of parachute drops and the chaos, destruction, and loss of life and property they create are far greater than any benefit they provide to our starving people. The optimal way to provide relief to our people and end the humanitarian crisis and systematic starvation is to open the land crossings and allow the flow of abundant quantities of humanitarian aid and food supplies on a daily basis and for extended periods. And these humiliating airdrops continue to kill starving people. On Monday, Uday Al-Quran, a nurse at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, was killed when an aid box fell from the sky onto his tent shelter. Just days before he was killed, Al-Quran was filmed denouncing the airdrops. Quote, "This is a humiliation," he said. "This is a humiliation first and foremost. The aid is not enough and isn't enough to fill half a truck." Al-Quran went on to show the paltry amount of aid from an airdrop, which he said was filled with sand. Meanwhile, Israeli forces at the Gaza boundary crossings and Israeli and American mercenary forces operating the private so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites continue to trap, injure, and kill starving Palestinians every day. The health ministry stated on Wednesday that at least 1,655 starving Palestinians have been killed and 11,800 have been injured since the end of May while trying to obtain food aid. On Friday, August 1st, Al Jazeera's Anas al-Sharif reported that for the first time, Israeli soldiers used silencers on their weapons to shoot at starving Palestinians seeking aid in Gaza. He spoke to multiple witnesses who confirmed the use of silencers in Beit Lahia, while the Trump administration's envoy Steve Witkoff and the U.S. ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee visited Gaza for several hours to tour the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation's operations. Anas al-Sharif said that Israeli soldiers were trying to inflict casualties without drawing too much attention. Huckabee, who is an evangelical Christian Zionist, said on Wednesday that the Trump administration is looking to scale up the number of GHF sites, expanding the 4 sites to an eventual 16. At the Kuwaiti hospital in Khan Yunis, the hospital's director, Dr. Suhaib Al-Hams, issued a public appeal to Palestinians to avoid the death traps because his staff cannot treat the sheer amount of victims coming in with gunshot wounds. He said on Wednesday that his hospital's wound dressing department was out of service, quote, due to a shortage of medical supplies. A group of United Nations experts this week called for the immediate dismantling of the GHF, demanding that the private company and its executives be held accountable and to allow, quote, experienced and humanitarian actors from the UN and civil society alike to take back the reins of managing and distributing life-saving aid. The experts urged member states to impose a full arms embargo on Israel due to its multiple violations of international law and suspend trade and investment agreements that may result in harming the Palestinians and hold corporate entities accountable. More reports are emerging of Palestinians who have disappeared while attempting to collect aid at the private U.S.-Israeli killing fields masquerading as aid distribution sites. This week, Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights and MENA Rights Group documented the case of 5 Palestinians, including a child, who disappeared at Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites. In 3 cases, the Israeli army acknowledged their detention, but denied having the 2 others, including the 16-year-old child, in their custody. The human rights groups say that of the 3 men that the army acknowledged taking from the so-called aid sites, quote, the Israeli army refused to disclose their place of detention and denied them their right to access legal counsel, placing them in incommunicado detention and at heightened risk of torture and ill treatment. In an appeal, the groups urged the UN Working Group on Enforced or Involuntary Disappearances to intervene with the Israeli authorities to clarify the fate and whereabouts of the 5 disappeared Palestinians and to immediately release those detained. The NGOs, quote, also requested that the UN Working Group address a communication to the GHF and to the relevant U.S. authorities in light of the mounting number of cases of enforced disappearances occurring at the aid distribution sites operated by the U.S. Israeli-backed organization. These five documented cases are only the tip of the iceberg, the groups say, and reveal yet another disturbing pattern of grave human rights violations committed by Israeli authorities in Gaza. Abductions of Palestinian civilians seeking humanitarian aid at distribution sites operated by the GHF. The Gaza Government Media Office issued a series of statements over the past week on the worsening of the humanitarian crisis and the reinforcement of engineered chaos in Gaza, in the context of Israel allowing in a trickle of aid trucks that fail to meet the enormous need of starving people. The media office stated on August 6th that over the past week and a half, the total number of aid trucks that have entered the Gaza Strip was only about 850, an average of 85 trucks per day, or about 14% of the required aid. Gaza needs at least 600 trucks of aid and fuel per day to meet the minimum demands of the health, service, and food sectors, the media office added. Most of the aid, the media office notes, is being looted by armed gangs working with the Israelis. There are approximately 22,000 aid trucks stuck at the crossings, the media office stated, quote, most of which belong to UN and international organizations and various entities. The Israeli occupation is deliberately preventing their entry as part of a systematic policy of engineered starvation, blockade, and chaos as part of the ongoing genocide. On the night of August 5th, at least 20 Palestinians were killed and dozens were injured when an aid truck overturned on top of people who were trying to obtain food. The Israelis forced the truck driver to drive on unsafe and damaged roads, which it had previously bombed and were not suitable for passage, the media office stated. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza reported on Thursday that at least four new deaths had been reported due to starvation, bringing the total recorded number of victims of Israel's starvation policy to 197, more than half of them children. Among them this week was 17-year-old Atif Abu Khater, who died on August 2nd. His weight had dropped from 154 pounds to just 55 pounds when he died, his family said, roughly what a 9-year-old child should weigh. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported from Gaza City, saying, quote, we hear from his family members and others who knew him that he used to be a local sports champion. He ended up losing a lot of weight, becoming acutely malnourished, and ultimately dying. He was one of thousands of severe malnutrition cases throughout Gaza. Doctors and medical staff are overwhelmed, meanwhile, with mass casualties and dwindling supplies, fuel, medications, and their own energy, as they too are starving. Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, the director of Al Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, said that his hospital's occupancy rate is at 300% and warned that anesthesia and blood units are in severely low supply. Quote, many of the injuries we receive are concentrated in the upper parts of the body. We are losing wounded people due to the lack of sufficient operating rooms, he told Al Jazeera Arabic. Dr. Tarek Loubani, a Canada-based emergency physician who is currently working in Gaza, told Al Jazeera on August 6th that there has not been a day in the last 2.5 months when there has not been a near complete shortage of blood. Quote, I cannot get out of my mind one of the cases in which a 1.5-year-old boy was right in front of us with a tiny little wound that happened to hit an artery. He was bleeding quite a bit, but not so much that he had to die, Loubani said. He was small, obviously malnourished, and all he needed was a little bit of blood. However, it was a tent massacre, and so every single member of his family had died. As a result, they weren't able to donate blood, he added. By the time we were able to find somebody to go and donate blood and bring it, we could see that even if we gave him blood, we weren't going to be able to follow it up, and that blood could be used to save somebody else. We had to sit there watching a little boy who we knew was savable and treatable die in front of us, Loubani said. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Hunger Makes Life Hell for Journalists by Iman Hillis, writing from Gaza. I can barely function as a journalist, and I can't even explain why, Iman writes. Quote, I am a fact-checking journalist. My job is to sit in front of my laptop and debunk false and misleading claims. Now, as I sit trying to type in a word, my fingers freeze and my brain refuses to connect one sentence to the next. This has been the issue for the past 4 months, ever since my family began surviving solely on lentils. No bread, no sweets, not even spices, just salt. Now, nearly 5 months after Israel announced its complete aid blockade on March 2nd, food is barely found in the markets. Even the animal feed that people resorted to eating during the severe food crisis in the early months of 2024 is now unavailable. My body has become weak over these months, losing 7 kilograms, weight I never wanted to lose. Skin on bones, this is what we are right now. In early July, Iman says that she fact-checked a claim made by a pro-Israel publication which is known for denying all of Gaza's suffering. She writes, quote, it had been publishing material denying that there is a food crisis in Gaza. The claims were accompanied by videos of the barely functioning restaurants. With an empty stomach, I visited the restaurants in question. I found them empty of customers. An owner of a restaurant showed me the restaurant's fridge. It was completely empty. After I headed home, I intended to complete my investigation and submit it. I had all the necessary details and photographs as evidence. All that was left was to put it together and submit it, a task that normally takes me no more than 2 hours. I sat, tried to type, couldn't focus, gave up. I repeated the process. The 2 hours it should have taken me for that task turned into 4 days. 4 days of useless attempts to focus, attempts to ignore the hunger pangs and the constant thoughts of food. But what I am enduring in this round of the food crisis is not the only reason why I cannot work. Several previous rounds of the crisis have pushed me to this edge. Those are excerpts from Hunger Makes Life Hell for Journalists by Iman Hillis, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. Members of the Samir Project, a mutual aid organization in Gaza, supported play and music therapy with children at the Rifat al-Arir camp for displaced families. These sessions with the experienced therapist Jaber and his team provide a safe space for the children to express themselves through music and various activities, the Samir Project writes.
Bye. Come on, bye.
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different U.S. and European cities. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Some of you may have heard, all of a sudden, and while apartheid Israel continues its slaughter, genocide, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing in Palestine, and the destruction of the Gaza Strip, you may have heard Britain and France saying that they might recognize a Palestinian state with conditions. A puzzling announcement while these countries are providing apartheid Israel with weapons and support to continue its slaughter and genocide of the Palestinians. There was a great opinion regarding this by Sumayya Al-Ghannouchi, a British Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics. She recorded that opinion for Middle East Eye, in which she says, quote, "A state that needs its oppressor's permission to exist is not a state. It's a diplomatic mirage sold over mass graves," unquote. Let's listen in.
You've probably seen it by now, France calling for Palestinian statehood, Keir Starmer pledging to recognize it at the right time, statements flying from European leaders about justice, peace, responsibility. Sounds noble, right? Wrong. Because this isn't a breakthrough, it's a distraction. Let's get real. What's being offered here isn't a state. It's a glorified municipality with no army, no borders, no control over airspace, water, resources, or even its own population movement. It's not statehood, it's a shell. It's a pseudo-state under total Israeli control, less than what was offered under Oslo, less than a Bantustan, just enough authority to manage people under siege, never enough to challenge the siege itself. And yet, Macron, Starmer and others parade this as progress. Progress for who? Macron wants to look like De Gaulle. He wants to use Palestine to relaunch France in the Arab world after losing influence in Africa. Saudi Arabia wants to use it to justify normalizing ties with Israel and dragging more Arab and Muslim countries to the Abraham Accords. Starmer, well, he's fooling no one. He's trying to salvage his image within a furious Labour base after backing Israel's war crimes from day one. So no, this isn't about Palestine, it's about optics. It's a diplomatic stunt dressed up as solidarity. And here's the thing, Starmer hasn't recognized Palestine, he's dangling it like bait. His logic, if Israel refuses to negotiate, maybe Britain will recognize Palestine to push them. But if Israel agrees to talks, well then no recognition. Would it want to derail the process? But let's get this straight, recognition isn't a right, it's a threat, something to be withheld if Israel plays along. It's backwards. If Starmer believed in two states, recognition would be the first step, not a bargaining chip. This is not diplomacy, this is appeasement. Gaza faces a manufactured famine, yet instead of halting the siege or sanctioning the siege masters, the West retreats into the fantasy of a virtual state. Words replace pressure, gestures replace justice. Israeli Heritage Minister says Gaza will be Jewish, that they must find Gazans more painful ways than death. This isn't rhetoric, it's policy, and the West keeps funding it. While Gaza starves, Macron and Starmer are offering a state on paper, a state that exists nowhere, because in the West Bank, settlements have swallowed it whole. From 1993 to now, the settler population more than doubled, from 250,000 to over 700,000, despite Oslo, because of Oslo. And here's the pattern. Every time Palestinians rise from the Intifada, the Second Intifada, or now when the world is watching and is sympathetic, the peace process returns not to bring freedom, but to bury it. The promise of a state is not used to deliver liberation, it is used to derail it. So let's rewind. In 1993, the PLO recognized Israel. They gave up 78% of historic Palestine just to negotiate over the remaining 22%, the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem. In return, a promise, a state. But the key issues, the refugees, the right to return, Jerusalem, settlements, were kicked down the road. Final status, perpetually under discussion. And what did Israel do? Expand settlements, build the apartheid wall, turn the West Bank into a fortress of walls, rows and watchtowers, and reshape the Palestinian Authority into a security subcontractor, policing its own people. That's the peace process they want to revive. And while they speak of process, over 186,000 Palestinians may have been killed in Gaza. That's not my number, that's from The Lancet. Starmer knows it, Macron knows it, and yet arms keep flowing. Funding continues, no sanctions, no pressure, just recognition as a headline. If they were serious about peace, they'd start by cutting weapons, imposing sanctions, demanding Israel end the occupation and the blockade. Instead, they're offering a flag, a seat at the UN, and total subjugation. Let's call it what it is. This isn't peace, it's the sale of illusions. It's not recognition, it's collaboration with apartheid. Because a state that needs its oppressor's permission to exist is not a state, it's a diplomatic illusion, it's theater over mass graves. So Macron, Starmer, all those selling this fantasy, answer this question. Where will this Palestinian state actually exist? in Gaza turned to dust, in the West Bank sliced by wars and settlements, in Jerusalem under annexation, or in Jordan, in Sinai, in Saudi Arabia, as Netanyahu suggested mockingly, or perhaps on Mars, if it's on the land occupied in 1967 then, and the occupation. If it's anywhere else, then it's ethnic cleansing with a new logo. Stop selling illusions. We see through the mirage.
That was Soumaya Al-Ghannouchi, a British-Tunisian writer and expert in Middle East politics, with an opinion for Middle East Eye. In May 2025, a historic Gaza tribunal, a gathering of international experts and human rights defenders, united to expose and address the crimes committed by Israel in Gaza, was held in Sarajevo. There were several speakers at that tribunal, and during this episode of Arab Voices, I will air a couple of the remarks delivered at the International Law Chamber about specific acts. I will air the remarks of Professor Maryam Jamshidi, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Colorado Law School, on the protection of civilians, and I will air a witness testimony by a volunteer physician in Gaza, Dr. Mimi Sayed, an American emergency medicine physician and assistant clinical professor at the University of Washington and Washington State University. Let's listen in, and the voice you will hear first is that of Dr. Nimer Soltani, a Palestinian legal scholar and reader in public law at SOAS University of London, who moderated that panel, introducing the speakers.
The third panel is entitled Specific Acts, and we have five excellent speakers. We'll have an exciting panel on different aspects of the genocide. We're going to start with Professor Maryam Jamshidi. Professor Jamshidi is an associate professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School, where she teaches and writes about international law, national security law, and tort law. She received her JD from the University of Pennsylvania, a master's degree in political theory from the London School of Economics, an undergraduate degree from Brown University. Professor Jamshidi is a member of the Middle East Studies Association's Committee on Academic Freedom and its Civil Rights Task Force, a board member of UNRWA USA, and a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Please help me welcome Professor Jamshidi.
Hello. So the core rules of international humanitarian law that protect civilians and civilian objects during armed conflict are vital. They have helped shift the laws of war away from their earlier focus on the military needs of states and towards their current predominant focus on protecting civilians and civilian objects from the scourges of war. In Israel's case, the systematic evisceration and disregard of these core rules is at the heart of its genocide against the Palestinian people. Because the civilian protection rules of IHL don't just attempt to shield civilians from war's destructive force. They also provide a crucial safeguard that prevents belligerents from using the fog of war as an excuse to perpetrate the crime of crimes, genocide. So I'll begin by briefly laying out IHL's four core civilian protection rules. I'll then describe a few of Israel's patterns of conduct and policies that underscore its flagrant and consistent violation of those rules. So there are several principles at the heart of the IHL regime for protecting civilians and civilian objects from harm. The principle of distinction, the principle of military necessity, the principle of proportionality, and the principle of humanity. These four rules have the status of customary international law, which means they are binding on all states, including Israel. Starting with the principle of distinction, according to this rule, parties to a conflict shall at all times distinguish between civilian and military objectives and shall direct their operations only against military objectives. What this basically means is that you can't target civilians or civilian structures. where there is any doubt as to whether a person or object is civilian, civilian status has to be accorded. Now, there are two primary ways in which belligerents can violate the principle of distinction, either by engaging in attacks that are indiscriminate or by deliberately targeting civilians or civilian objects. An indiscriminate attack is an attack that was not directed at a specific military objective or that could not, by its very nature, be directed at or have its effects restricted to such targets. A deliberate attack is different. It involves the intent or purpose to harm civilian persons or things. The next core principle of civilian protection is the principle of military necessity. According to this principle, belligerents can only apply that amount and kind of force against military objectives, which includes combatants, that is necessary to realizing their military goals. Now, even though states have flexibility in setting those goals, that flexibility isn't limitless. For example, actions that are unlawful under international law, like genocide, can't be pursued. States can only pursue those military aims that are lawful under the UN Charter, which basically restricts a state's armed actions to those necessary to its self-defense. Because the self-defense right only gives states a limited right to defend against immediate or imminent threats, the principle of military necessity probably doesn't allow a state to pursue its adversary's total and complete destruction. The third core principle is the principle of proportionality, which has been described as the central pillar for civilian protection. Under this principle, attacks against military objectives that are expected to cause excessive losses to civilians or civilian objects, as compared to the concrete or direct military advantage that would result from an attack, are prohibited. What this means is that in conducting each and every attack against a military objective, belligerents are obligated to assess whether incidental harm to civilians or civilian objects is likely, and if so, whether that harm is expected to be excessive as compared to the military gain from the specific attack in question. The last core principle for civilian protection is the principle of humanity. This principle requires belligerents to adopt precautions to protect civilians and civilian objects from harm. This means doing things like taking feasible steps to ensure attacks are directed only at military objectives. It involves adopting means of attack that avoid or at least minimize incidental losses to civilians and civilian objects. It means refraining from attacks that are likely to be disproportionate. It also means, where possible, providing advance warnings to civilians of attacks that may affect them. There is ample evidence Israel has systematically and deliberately violated all four of these principles of civilian protection. Now, generally, to assess violations of IHL, we look to each discrete incident and evaluate whether the actions taken were lawful. In the situation of Gaza, that analysis, which various human rights organizations have already conducted and are continuing to conduct, has and will continue to show innumerable discrete IHL violations by the Israeli government. But what is particularly striking about Israel's nearly 20-month onslaught is the litany of policies and patterns of conduct that clearly demonstrate Israel's widespread disregard and manipulation of the four core IHL principles. These principles, these policies, these patterns paint a startling picture of Israel's military strategy in Gaza. That strategy is one that depends upon the holistic dismantling of IHL's civilian protection rules in order to destroy, depopulate, and eviscerate the conditions of life necessary to the Palestinian people's survival. Let's start with the pattern of destruction Israel has pursued in Gaza. Since October 7th, Israel has directly killed more than 53,000 Palestinians, according to the very conservative estimates of the Gaza Ministry of Health. This figure includes over 16,000 children. The actual death toll in Gaza is likely much higher, perhaps even double the total figure from the ministry. Indirect deaths caused by malnutrition and disease are projected to be in the hundreds of thousands. Over 120,000 Palestinians, at least, have been injured in Israeli attacks. Since October 7th, Israel has destroyed or damaged 70% of all structures in Gaza, including annihilating or damaging 92% of residential housing and nearly 90% of all schools, as well as all universities. It has demolished or rendered unusable civilian infrastructure vital for sustaining life in Gaza, including water infrastructure and agricultural lands, as my colleague Ms. Imad discussed earlier. This volume of civilian harm can only lead to the conclusion that the Israeli government has systematically and deliberately attacked civilian persons and objects in Gaza. Israel has also adopted policies that further demonstrate its complete disregard for the principle of distinction. It has, for example, embraced strategies that de-civilianize the entirety of Gaza's population and much of its territory. This includes broadly defining Gaza's civilians and civilian objects as targetable extensions of Hamas's so-called terrorist infrastructure. Since the start of its onslaught, Israel has also treated the entirety of North Gaza as a military objective, which is a blatant violation of the distinction principle on its face. Things are even worse now. Currently, 80% of the Gaza Strip is treated as a military no-go zone by Israel. The Israeli government has adopted AI targeting protocols like the Lavender Program, which upend what it means to be a civilian under the principle of distinction. Lavender does this by targeting people not based on their direct participation in hostilities or their membership in an armed group, but rather based on their so-called shared characteristics with known members of Hamas or other Palestinian groups. Since the total destruction of an adversary almost certainly goes beyond the UN Charter's limits, Israel has most probably violated the principle of military necessity by making the annihilation of Hamas a core military goal. Its pursuit of genocide and ethnic cleansing also presumptively violates the principle of military necessity. Other policies demonstrate how Israel has gutted the principle of proportionality of its protective force. Instead of assessing proportionality based on the military advantage from each discrete attack, Israel has adopted a test that weighs the harm to civilians or civilian objects against the overall purpose of the war itself. This approach, which will almost always mean that attacks are deemed proportionate, basically turning the proportionality principle into a justification for the killing of civilians en masse. Israel has also defied the principles of good faith and reasonableness at the heart of the proportionality assessment by loosening its rules of engagement to permit the killing of up to 15 to 20 civilians in order to eliminate a junior Hamas officer and up to 100 civilians to assassinate a single commander. Finally, Israel has pursued policies that demonstrate its deliberate and consistent disregard for the principle of humanity. In numerous cases, Israel has failed to provide any warning to civilians before targeting civilian structures like homes. Since the start of the armed conflict, it has systematically attacked the so-called safe zones that it has created. Israel has even weaponized the principle of humanity to facilitate its attacks on civilians. So-called humanitarian corridors have been consistently subjected to bombardment, shelling, and sniper fire. Where civilians have refused to comply with Israel's evacuation orders, which they are permitted to do under international law, Israel has used that noncompliance as an excuse to directly target them. These are just a few examples, the proverbial tip of the iceberg, of how Israel has shredded IHL's protections for civilians and civilian objects through its onslaught against the Palestinian people. The names of those being projected on the screen are but a fraction of the lives lost as a direct result of Israel's crimes. The full video, which is 7 months old and therefore missing thousands of names, goes on for another hour and 45 minutes. We stand on the edge of the world where war makes genocide permissible and humanity is swallowed by the military and security interests of powerful states. To face down this nightmare, it is not just urgent and crucial to end these crimes now. It is vital to ensure that Israel is held fully accountable for what it has done to the people of Palestine. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Jamshidi. Next is Dr. Mimi Sayed, who's an American emergency medicine physician and assistant clinical professor at the University of Washington and Washington State University. She's a fellow of the American College of Emergency Physicians. During the current Israeli onslaught on Gaza, she has volunteered to work during several months long stints at both Al-Aqsa Hospital and Nasser Hospital. Since then, she has given numerous interviews to American international media outlets and spoken widely at public and academic forums about her observations regarding the destruction of the Palestinian healthcare system in Gaza by Israel's military offensive. Please help me welcome Dr. Mimi Sayed.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mimi Sayed. I'm a board-certified emergency medicine physician, and I've been to Gaza twice. I went last year in August for a month at Al-Nasser Hospital, and then I went again in December to Al-Aqsa Hospital again for 4 weeks. I stand before you today not just as a physician, but as a mother and a human being who bears the truths that have been etched into my soul during my time in Gaza. I have seen the unthinkable, the inhumane, and the utterly heart-wrenching. The children of Gaza, with their eyes wide open and full of innocence, have been subjected to horrors that no child should ever face. I have seen them murdered, starved, and denied the most basic of human rights. Their cries for help echo in my mind, a haunting symphony of suffering that I cannot escape. The patients I treated in Gaza were the majority of children under the age of 12. On my first trip to Gaza in August, I have at least 18 documented cases of children who arrived in my emergency department with bullets to the head or the chest, and by witnesses reported to be shot by snipers or quadcopters. I have seen more brain matter out of skulls of small children due to shrapnel injuries than I ever thought possible in my entire lifetime. I will never forget the image of parents bringing their dead children wrapped in blankets and laying them on the floor so we could check for a pulse before pronouncing them all dead. This was a daily routine in Gaza, multiple times a day. The long line to the morgue where family members would wait for their loved ones so they could bury them with some shred of dignity will always be an unforgotten memory for me. Even when we did save some children from the jaws of death, their survival is at the mercy of the Israeli military's next airstrike or food deprivation. On my second trip in December, during a mass casualty incident, I recall an 8-year-old little girl named Ala. She arrived in an ambulance to Nasser Hospital with her father next to her. She was hit by a piece of shrapnel that opened her skull to expose half of her brain. Even though she was still moving slightly, given her devastating injury, the plan was to let her die because the rate of survival was very low for her. However, when I looked into the eyes of her father, I could not allow her to die without at least trying to stabilize her for further treatment. I imagined my own 8-year-old daughter laying there. I immediately secured her airway with a laryngoscope I had to smuggle in because I wasn't allowed to bring it in by the Israeli military. By some miracle, I was able to get her to surgery, and 3 weeks later, she was talking, reading, and walking, and even saying, Shukran, doktora, anam khair, 3 weeks later. Although I was able to help this little girl, she continues to have the threat of death looming over her at all times. She needs medical evacuation because there's only a skin flap covering her brain. She's at risk for infection, malnourishment, and death that was created by the Israeli government. I have photographs that speak louder than words, images of children playing in sewage, their laughter echoing in the streets flooded with waste. The lack of functioning sewage system and clean drinking water has created a public health crisis of monumental proportions. Babies, mere infants, were coming into our hospital with sepsis and organ failure, and their tiny bodies ravaged with high levels of E. coli. Chronic diarrhea is a constant for all children in Gaza, a completely preventable and unnecessary condition. The Israeli government's restriction of supplies for water purification is a death sentence for all of the children there. We are not just talking about infrastructure. We are talking about the very essence of human dignity and the right to life. It is important to note that all of these deplorable conditions are being manufactured deliberately by the Israeli government. In December, I treated a 29-year-old woman arrived at our hospital at Al-Aqsa with three small children next to her on the cot. She was bleeding profusely from an overgrown breast tumor, a condition that was curable with timely chemotherapy and surgery. It started off at the size of an olive in her breast. Prior to October 7th, she could have received this life-saving treatment in Gaza. But now this was impossible. She was denied evacuation even though she was approved by WHO. She was denied four times by the Israeli government for medical evacuation. By the time she reached me, there was nothing I could do to stabilize her. She came in bleeding from her breast tumor, so highly vascularized. I could only give her 2 units of blood, a temporary reprieve before she inevitably bled out in front of her three children on the cot. My colleagues later notified me that she had passed. This tragedy is not an isolated incident. The healthcare system in Gaza has been systematically dismantled with shortages of medical supplies, equipment, and personnel. The lack of basic medical supplies has made our job as healthcare providers nearly impossible. We were forced to work without gloves, hand soap, running water, or even electricity many times. I met healthcare workers who had been imprisoned and tortured. Their crime? Simply working in the hospital on October 7th. They were beaten, humiliated, and subjected to unspeakable acts of cruelty. Healthcare workers who are supposed to be protected under international law have also been repeatedly targeted. Dr. Abu Safia from Kamal Adwan Hospital is a stark example. He remains imprisoned and abused without charge, his only crime being his dedication to saving lives. Even paramedics are not spared. There would be airstrikes towards ambulances who were getting shot at while trying to bring wounded patients to the hospital. Every ambulance I saw had bullet holes or damage done to it by the Israeli military. In the past 18 months, we have also seen a disturbing pattern of targeting journalists who are the eyes and ears of the world in these troubling times. Among them was my friend, Ayman Al-Gedi. The day he was brutally killed by an Israeli airstrike, Ayman visited me at Al-Aqsa Hospital. He was anxiously awaiting the birth of his first child with his wife. His excitement was palpable, and his hope for the future was a beacon of light in the darkness of Gaza. His car that was marked Press was struck by an Israeli missile that night. He was killed along with four other journalists right in front of the hospital where his son was born the next day. During my time in Gaza in December, I witnessed the targeting of civil defense workers. One night, a dozen civil defense workers who were trying to repair the sewage system arrived at our hospital. Half of them were already dead, and others were severely injured. Another night, when long-awaited humanitarian aid finally entered through the checkpoint, the civil defense workers guarding it from the looters was struck by bombs from the Israeli military. These were family men with young children. They all arrived dead except for one man in his early 20s. I was able to save him for one night so his family could say goodbye to him. The next day he passed away. His crime was trying to protect the aid from coming in so it could be distributed appropriately. In all my time when I lived there, working in the hospitals in Gaza, I never once saw Hamas fighters or weapons in the hospital. The only people we treated were civilians. The rhetoric the Israeli government uses to justify bombings is unwarranted, untrue, and a downright crime. With my testimony today, I would like to call to action. We must stop arming the Israeli government. We must place sanctions on them in order to stop this mass murder of innocent children. Starvation should never be used as a weapon. There must be a permanent and sustained ceasefire and unlimited aid allowed to enter. We must not forcibly displace the people of Gaza, but empower them to heal and repair their own state. It is difficult for me to criticize other countries when my own government is overwhelmingly enabling these crimes. Past U.S. presidents have had courage to stop arms to Israel when it was unjustly bombing other countries. And I call on my own president, President Trump, to do the same. Thank you.
That was Dr. Mimi Sayed, an American emergency medicine physician and assistant clinical professor at the University of Washington and Washington State University, delivering her witness testimony at the Gaza Tribunal held in Sarajevo in May 2025. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston since 2002 and syndicated on other radio stations in different U.S. and European cities. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.